This podcast brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Bertarelli reporting from Aero 2019 in Friedrichshafen, Germany. I'm with Pete Bunce, who's president of Gamma. Pete, you knew I was going to throw this at you, so you've had a few minutes to think about it. There's fallout, or there's going to be fallout, from the Boeing MAX certification issues, aviation in general. And a lot of that is probably going to come focus on what's called ODA, which, if I got this right, is Organizational Designee Authority.
Designation Authorization.
Authorization. So that allows DERs and DARs, which we know all about in general aviation. Mm-hmm. They're mainstay in general aviation. So what are you sensing and feeling here?
Well, I'm after the initial rush, and we were concerned that the political apparatus, in especially in the U.S., would react before they had the facts. And what I'm feeling, or at least sensing now over the last week, is that, okay, everybody's calming down and saying, we've had preliminary accident investigations, now we're going to get more data in, we're going to let Secretary Chao's process work, we've got an IG investigation going on, we're going to constitute the SOCAC, which came out of last reauthorization, which we very much support, and that it'll have a subcommittee of that to be able to start really looking at, okay, what can we learn from this process here? You know, and as you said, you're very astute in the fact that this will have impacts, or have a discussion that we need to have across the board, you know, how we train people. And we're at an interesting time in aeronautics and aerospace right now because, you know, we're not fully automated. We're using automation to make aircraft fly like a traditional airplane, especially when you have fly-by-wire. We have to do things to aircraft. We still have men and women in the loop. We give the airplane back to men and women after they've been flying on the automation a lot at critical times where they probably don't have the proficiency, because the only place you can get that is in a simulator. So all of these things will get in. And the good thing is that the entire aerospace community will be better from a very thorough set of investigations. I'm very glad that the FAA, who I think has been doing a tremendous job of being able to try to tell the story of a very complex system of certification, but also basic aerodynamics of how an airplane flies to a public that, and political folks that some of them don't have time to understand, and that are just reacting to reports that also are reporting to a public that doesn't understand a lot of these very complex concepts. So I am encouraged. Yesterday, I understand the NTSB briefed the leaders of the House T&I committee, both Republicans and Democrats, together. I think that's very healthy. And I think I've got great faith in the NTSB, and I've got great faith in the FAA that we're going to get to the bottom of this and then work with international authorities to be able to say, okay, where do we need to go from here?
Do you think what might be the typical effect on the general aviation level here? Because every company is using the designees of some type, and some more than others. What conceivably could happen? Can you have any sense of it?
Well, I think if there's specific things out of here of what we look at in whether it's software development or we look at the automation piece, but overall we all know that the expertise for modern aerospace resides with the industry primarily, and that we use designees for our side, manufacturing side, we use it in operations all the time. I mean, I had my folks do the numbers. Last year, 48,000 certifications were given on the ops side for maintainers, for pilots, everything else. The FAA did 2,700 of those out of their own folks. So designees, and we call it something different in Europe and something different in down in Brazil, but government has to rely on that expertise that lies out in the industry, otherwise the industry just stops. Right now it takes us 6 years to get a certification project through, and look at all we're going to be throwing at them with this electric propulsion and innovation and all of this urban air mobility and electrification and everything. We're just going to throw more and more work at the regulators. They're going to have to rely on industry, but we've got to do it smart. It's got to be a risk-based approach, and that's really what ODA is all about, is to be able to look at a company that invests very heavily so that the FAA can do proper safety oversight of that organization, but to let the experts do what they did. And obviously, we are going to, again, through this accident investigation, we'll probably learn something just like we do any time that we put on an AD or anything else. And, you know, any loss of life is tragic. There's no doubt about it, and I'm not mitigating that. But we all know what a rarefied situation we live in aviation compared to how many people we kill on the roads every year, new vehicles, old vehicles, people texting, rail cars, you know, boating, all that kind of thing. So we get a microscope put us on aviation because it's sensationalized very much. And we have to live with that as manufacturers and learn from it and get better.
And speaking of certification, one bit of good news here is on sustainable alternative jet fuels basically have been certified or the specs exist and the industry agrees on them. So that's getting to be a topic of conversation here. Where are we with all of that? And I know you mentioned that we've got some demonstrations coming up at eBase in May.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're excited to be able to show what business aviation is doing in this realm. Now, we are very much, because of what we consume in fuel compared to what our commercial brethren use, we're very tied to how they're doing it. But we want to be able to build the demand with our commercial brothers to be able to say, we know there are customers out there, entities that want to fly with this fuel because it's just part of their social corporate responsibility in that. Our job is to be able to create the demand so that then the supply chain starts to go in action. In Europe, we only right now have one refinery supplier, and then that through the fuel distributors and everything that goes to multiple ones. In the U.S., we have more than one, and that's actually where they have a build-out plan. So part of this is our industry creating awareness that we as a community need to build the demand for this product so that the supply chain starts building up. And then the more that we can partner with our commercial brethren to be able to get different installations to have this available, the more people start using it, and it'll just become a normal course of life. And it's really one of the only levers we have to be able to meet our aspirational goals of carbon neutral growth.
What do you make of the economics of this? What's Gamma's view of it?
Well, obviously it's total supply and demand economics 101. If we create the demand, so supply is produced, the more demand, the price starts to go down. If you look at turbine aviation, though, and you look at the cost of fuel as compared to the cost of operations of everything else that we pay, especially over here in Europe where we all know costs are higher, the fuel starts to become a smaller and smaller piece of the overall cost per flying hour of operating an aircraft. So if you are a corporate operator and you want to demonstrate your social responsibility and saying, you know, I know I can do something good by buying this fuel, we believe that'll happen.
Yeah, so that suggests, Europe is clearly more carbon aware than the U.S. is. And we've talked about the initiatives that are underway here that relate to environmental and ecological concerns. Does the U.S. play a driving role in the economics of these fuels being sustainable?
Absolutely. I think what we learned through the process that we did at Van Nuys in January is that companies can make money with this, and the more demand that we build, more companies will say this is a money maker because they can use waste product, agricultural waste product and everything. So you're not, you know, there was a discussion maybe about 10 years ago, I'm sure you remember it, where people were talking about, well, you can't take food away. You know, we don't want to take food stocks away from people that need to eat in this world and everything. But when you're talking about waste products and the different ways now it's advancing to be able to go ahead and produce this stuff, you now have a sustainable flow that doesn't negatively impact what we want to do is feed the planet and not have people poor and hungry.
And do those companies think that they can make it cost competitive with existing fossil fuels?
I think they can make it cost attractive. I think it's very, we never know with the volatility of oil, you know, if we're going to get back to a state where we were before. There was unquestionably where we were, what would you say, 5-6 years ago, where the cost per barrel was fairly expensive. There was a very clear economic case there, a much stronger one that can be made now. But now we see in the price of oil, I think it reached a peak the other day of the last year or so and everything. So that volatility, and we all know the price is going to go up eventually. So creating the demand, I think, starts with people wanting to fly with this fuel to be able to meet their sustainability commitments. But over time, if the demand is there, price point is going to start coming down just because supply will build up.
And I think you said there are about five manufacturers who have an actual product?
In the U.S., there are different refiners that are coming online that have plans to be able to do the product. I think on the West Coast there are two producing right now, but I don't quote me on those numbers because I got to go back and look at my notes and everything, because it's very even when you start going to this, you go, okay, well, who is the refiner and who is the distributor? So you got to straighten it out in your mind, because they're not names that just come immediately to mind. But I think you read recently, Boeing has a stock up there in the Northeast. We know that Gulfstream is flying it with their stock down in Savannah. Bombardier was flying it with some of the fuel that they had available there in Montreal. So more and more of the OEMs are saying, well, let's make this fuel available so our customers, at least when they fly out of here, they can fly with it, get the confidence that there's no difference than normal jet fuel. So.
And they've got an approved spec, right? They've had it for several years.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, when you and I pull up to the gas pump and there's a little sticker on there that says E95, you know, nobody pays any attention to it because it's been in the fuel forever. We have different levels and different mixtures that happen different times of the year depending on where you live in the U.S. It all works fine. And jet fuel is, you know, we can burn a lot of different things in jet fuel and meet the spec, and this will just add to it. And it's actually, as I've learned in this process, there are some properties of it that actually are better because it's got some chemical properties that actually make performance better on the aircraft itself.
Pete Buds, thanks for the update.
All right, Paul. Thank you. Good seeing you.
Paul Bertarelli reporting from Aero. Thanks for listening.
This podcast brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.